come to order. Today we will be discussing the Governor's College of Education Reform proposal that's in his budget that was released in January. It's part of the Governor's Teacher Transformation Act. Bill language hasn't been introduced yet, but we wanted to have this discussion early. And today we have with us Karen Clemzing, Assistant Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Education, and John Mielitz, is that how it sounds? Okay, Director Educator Licensing with the Minnesota Department of Education. Would you like to present?
Thank you, committee, for having us here today to talk about teacher education. We'll talk about what it should look like as expectations change in the 21st century. What's expected of our graduates from high school these days is very different from what was expected when we all graduated and when our parents graduated. So we're going to talk about what then teacher preparation should look like to be aligned with those new expectations. The 21st century global economy has changed those expectations, and so has the information technology age, and it's really ramped up expectations for students, especially in places like the area of critical thinking, which includes logic taught in high-level geometry, proofs, and algebra, as well as communication skills, which we expect at a much faster, more professional pace than ever. So the governor is recommending, as part of his Teacher Transformation Act, and this is just one piece of that we're talking about today. You'll hear about other pieces of the Teacher Transformation Act as we go forward, so this is only part of it. This is the part that would talk about goals for colleges of education, of teacher education. The governor recommends changes in three policies in this area to create these 21st century colleges of teacher education. The first is to establish minimum entrance requirements for students prior to admission into teacher preparation programs, especially focusing on passage of Praxis 1, also referred to as the pre-professional skills test, or you may know it as the PPST. The second one is to raise the expectations on the content-specific certification exam. This is known as Praxis 2, and it's the content portion of that, by raising the passing cut score in those areas. And the third is to increase the rigor on the standards of effective practice for beginning teachers, also known as the SEP, Standards of Effective Practice, or the pedagogy part of the Praxis 2. And to raise these standards, to increase emphasis on technology skills and expectations with respect to master's content and pedagogy. For those of you who aren't as familiar with the current steps to becoming a teacher, we're going to just quickly review in two slides how that happens. First, you gain entrance into approved teacher preparation program in Minnesota. Those programs are approved by the Board of Teaching, and it is the separate colleges of education who define what entrance requirements are needed to get into those programs. So currently, we can't tell you what the most normal entrance requirements are because there's so many of them given the number of colleges of education, teacher education we have. The current teacher prep program entrance requirements are determined uniquely by each of those teacher prep programs in Minnesota. And then the teacher has to complete the college's teacher prep program. The next thing that happens is the teacher then, after completing that program, also has to pass the pre-professional skills test, which is a basic reading, writing, and math skills test usually taken prior to entrance to teacher college, but passage is not currently required for admission. So we do have teachers who graduate from their teacher preparation colleges who have not passed this basic skills test, and there are some who teach for 3 years with permission in the classroom not having passed this exam. Then they have to pass also the Praxis 2 test, the subject and pedagogy specific test, which is usually taken after completion of a teacher prep program. Both of these tests are developed by ETS, which is chosen in a competitive RFP process. And then passing cut scores for the Praxis test are established by Minnesota review panels, composed of in-the-field teachers and other accepted Minnesota experts in the field. And then the test scores are submitted, and the teacher prep program diplomas are submitted to BOT, and then Minnesota Department of Education, implementing the BOT rules, issues an official license. So the governor is rationale for making changes is that teacher effectiveness has been shown to be a leading indicator of student success. Minnesota teacher candidates should be proficient on basic reading, writing, and math skills. And our current Praxis 1, or PPSP, for teacher prep candidates in Minnesota tests the potential teacher candidates' basic skills and their college readiness. So this is not a test of whether they're proficient in college skills, but rather pre-college skills. And that the pre-professional skills test is administered to students entering teacher prep programs. Currently, 22 states require passing a basic skills examination prior to entrance into a teacher preparation program. Praxis 1 is offered both in traditional paper and pencil method as well as in electronic form, and test scores are determined by a validation panel consisting of 15 teachers and 15 higher education representatives. Currently, in the mathematics PPSP, you can see the test scores here, and I'm not going to belabor them because they're in your PowerPoint that you have. But you can see the passage rates are not 100%. Additionally, when you look at the computerized examination, we still hover between 85 and 91% on passage rates. So it's still, most of our teachers would still pass this basic skills test to get into the program if we were to pass this legislation. The concern currently is that there is no requirement for candidates to pass this examination prior to entering a teacher prep program. Teachers have up to 3 years in which to teach on a limited license that does have to be approved by the Board of Teaching while attempting to pass this basic skills examination. Some of the teachers teaching our students have not passed this high school level reading, writing, and math assessment that state and the field experts say are necessary. So the governor proposes making a passing score on the PPSP an entrance requirement for Minnesota teacher preparation programs. That teachers should not go into a teacher prep program until they've passed this test. Another concern is that the quality of the teacher preparation system has been questioned in independent research studies for not requiring the equivalence of an academic major in the core content areas where teacher candidates are preparing to teach. So the governor proposes revising the teacher licensing exams to ensure a candidate can demonstrate the equivalence of an academic major in the core content areas for which they are applying the licensure. This would require us to up the requirements and the rigor of our current Praxis 2. And then additionally, direct the Board of Teaching to adopt rules requiring candidates for licensure in the core content areas to evidence the equivalence of an academic major in the core content areas for which they are applying for licensure. The third concern is that as technology and critical thinking expectations of 21st century classroom have changed so much, the standards of effective practice for beginning teachers. Teachers need to apply strategies using technology in all content areas. Teachers need to apply classroom strategies to promote higher levels of critical thinking in students than ever before. So the governor proposes revising the standards of effective practice assessment to emphasize and assess a teacher candidate's ability to apply more advanced technology, and revise this assessment to assess a teacher's mastery of pedagogical approaches to teaching content that promote students to engage in high-level critical thinking, especially with students who have not had as much exposure to critical thinking and technology. So, to finish it off, the governor recommends one-time appropriations. It's a pretty minimal investment for some, I think, pretty big gains. $40,000 in fiscal year 2010, $45,000 in fiscal year 2011 to fund the work to align the Praxis 1 and 2 for teachers and candidates, which set the minimum goals and standards for teacher preparation programs in Minnesota colleges and universities.
Thank you. And before we go further, we do have a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the February 5th meeting? Representative Bryant moves the approval of the minutes for February 5th, 2009. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, would you like questions now or would you like Mr. Mielek to go first?
That's it for our presentation, so we can take questions at this
time. Okay. First on the list is Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little bit ago you were talking about that the teachers have to pass a test, or they don't have to pass the test. They can teach for 3 years before they pass this test. How many teachers do we have that are doing that currently? Are we talking a handful, or is this a solution in search of a problem, or do we really have a lot of teachers out there that are doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, currently the data shows that we have approximately 31 teachers who are teaching without the PTSD.
Any other questions? Okay. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Clemson, did you happen to see the article that was in the New York Times recently about teachers and evaluating them and so forth? I just got it handed to me by Representative Kahn and read it over the weekend, and so I'm going to ask the rest of my question, too, rather than did just you see that article. The article made the point, which is contrary to the governor's recommendation, on narrowing the base of teachers that get to go into the field, which is why I'm asking the question. There the point was being made that teaching is an art, not a science. You can't measure it by a test. And hence, we should be getting as many teachers into the field as possible, and then as they get vetted and we get them into the field, then they get narrowed down and we have severe winnowing at that point, that it's the wrong place to winnow is before they get into the field. The article made the comparison with financial planners, for instance. There, again, it's hard to tell who's going to be a good financial planner, and so they just try to get as many into the field as possible with the goal of getting 100 or 150 really good ones. But only after they're in the field and they see how they're doing and if they're nimble on their feet and having success and keeping clients, do they, you know, that's when they cut the wheat from the chaff. And so I'm just wondering whether you saw it or not, if you could comment on where do you get your idea to narrow who can go in it rather than have severe winnowing after they're out there and we can see what they can do.
Ms. Clemson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would not look at this as a winnowing effect, especially given that the question about is this a solution in search of a problem. I think the idea is to find out which of these teachers you really want to teach, which ones don't have the basic skills up front, because it's easier to provide supports and interventions for them in college than it is 3 years after they're in the classroom and they still can't pass the test, but they really want to be there and they want. So I think this really will help us as a state in the colleges of teacher education focus a little bit more on getting those teachers those basic skills interventions right off the bat rather than waiting until their third year when they're thinking about leaving the classroom because they can't get their license. Secondly, I think that this is like the board for teachers. And we wouldn't ask, and I know this doesn't happen with lawyers and with the boards for doctors, where they would actually want doctors teaching who haven't passed basic boards, or lawyering who haven't passed basic boards. And so this is not the end all be all. Not all lawyers make it, not all doctors make it. There's an art to being a doctor and there's an art to being a lawyer. And we want teachers to start getting paid like that, so I think we have to start treating the profession much like that as well. And so I think this is an opportunity for us to really show as a profession that we are willing to commit to these entrance requirements for teachers. And this is very much in line. I don't see Representative Erdahl here today, but a couple of legislators have called and asked why don't we look at the Finland model? And they are another model of teacher education that does have entrance requirements for these kinds, for being a teacher. And they don't look at it as winnowing. They look at it as really incentivizing the top flyers to go into teaching and supporting those who really need the support when they need the support.
Thank you. We have about we have five people waiting to ask questions, and I think we have about five more minutes to talk. So if we could keep our questions short, we'll let everybody talk. Representative Peterson.
It's okay.
Okay. Representative Cass.
Question I have is on the context of the Praxis one. Why stating that it needs to be as an entrance into the program rather than say that before they can actually graduate from the program? My idea there is that if we want to keep as many qualified people as possible in the actual structure, saying, hey, we want to get teachers out there and we want to make sure there's enough supply of teachers, why would we not do that as a condition of graduation rather than actually entrance? And the context of that is then is that if we have some basic standards, they could meet that as part of a formative assessment throughout their college career. And so question, and the second thing then is, of those 31 that right now are teaching without master of that Praxis exam, how many of them are effective teachers? Do we have any measurement of that?
Mr. Milek, whichever.
So, I'll respond to the 31 first. The effectiveness of teaching and the evaluation of teachers once they're in the classroom is really done on a school-by-school, district-by-district basis. So we don't have a consistent approach to how that's done. And this is really not working or dealing with that issue at this point. But to go back to your question about whether it should be an entrance into the program exam, it is a basic skills exam. It is not a college skills exam. This is an exam that measures whether the student has the ability to do well in college. So I think that we need to look at the PTSP as an entrance requirement so that we are really ensuring that the best and brightest are getting into the program. And those who don't have those skills yet, that we are focusing on getting those skills before they get into the program, so that once they're in the program, they can focus on the high rigor of what's needed to master the content and master the pedagogy to teach, and not have to split their time, because they're already struggling to do basic skills. I don't think we want our teacher candidates to be trying to split their time between trying to do well in three areas. They should be ready by the point they enter the teacher prep program to focus on content mastery and the pedagogy to teach it.
One of the other concerns that this would raise as a graduation requirement is currently when those people get to their third year of teaching and haven't passed that exam, they're done. And so sometimes we'll get a phone call from the superintendent who says, I've got a fantastic teacher, they're excellent, they've taken that math test 12 times. Can't you just give them something? And we can't. And so if we put this on as a graduation requirement, you may end up with a situation where we're getting phone calls from the colleges saying, we've got this person who's completed the program except for mathematics Praxis. How do we graduate them and get them licensed? So by having that as the front-end entrance requirement, hopefully we're saving some of those phone calls and frustrations on the candidate part.
Did I ask your question?
Follow-up with that then is that, you know, if you're getting these phone calls from superintendents saying that this is an excellent teacher, how can we get them to pass this test? The question is, then, how is it a measurement of effectiveness of a teacher then? And that's the question I have, is that if we have people that are getting through and are going into the classroom and are extremely effective, I don't understand then how it's a gauge. And I'd like to have that answered.
I think that's a great question. And this is a basic skills test. It's not a pedagogy test. It's not a test of their competence in their ability to teach. It's a measure of whether they have basic college readiness, math, reading, and writing skills.
I'd like to respond to that, too. There is definitely, with the research on effectiveness of teaching, there's a high correlation with the art of teaching, the skills, that it's not just about content mastery, and that's why there's a pedagogy side of the test. But there's also a very high correlation with content mastery combined with the pedagogy skills that far outpasses and surpasses in correlation research the effect of just having being good with kids but not knowing your math. So what I think we want to do is make sure that we don't throw the other part out, which is currently the effective strategies and the pedagogy that cannot just be measured by tests, but part of it can be measured by tests, as can the content mastery. We need to keep that. We need to raise the rigor there, and we also need to beef up the other side. But we got to set the goals first, and I think that the goals are well set by this test and the research supports the teachers who know have their basic skills and are well have a good mastery of the content as well as a good mastery of the pedagogy have a higher correlation. Their effectiveness is more highly correlated with student achievement. So I don't think we want to put teachers in a place where they feel like they can't do the algebra needed. And we've heard this from some teachers. They love kids. They know how to keep, you know, discipline in the classroom, but they, when it gets to a certain point in the curriculum, they can't help them because they can't do the math.
Okay.
Just one little comment about that then, is I'd like to see the research then, is that overall content knowledge, or is it what they are teaching content specific? I think there's two very, very different things there, and so I'd like to see the research that would prove that it's about overall content knowledge versus content specific as to what they're teaching.
Is that something you can supply him with, or do you want to respond?
Yeah, we can supply you with that. There is a minimum level of basic competency the teachers need. They need to be a couple grade levels ahead of the students they're teaching. And the PPST is really gauging whether you have the high school skills to be able to make it through college. So if you have a high school teacher, you better hope that they can pass the PPST before they go into a teacher prep program.
Okay, we need to move on. Representative Dupke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one quick question. We talked about raising this cut score for the different levels of passing rate. If we raised the cut score today, what percent of the teachers would pass in each one of those areas? Do you know that?
We have information on that, but it depends on which discipline you're looking at, which content area, because the cut score has been set in different places depending on the discipline. The recommended cut score is not always the cut score that's accepted. We recently had this debate last year with the Board of Teaching. Sometimes the cut score is set higher, sometimes it's set lower than the recommended amount in order to ensure that more students can get their license. So we can get to that discipline by discipline if you would like.
I'm just interested in the numbers that you currently, the way you have it broken down. I think there's six areas. If you've got it like that, that would be great. Like the first one, PPSG Mathematics Cut Score 171, and it's 89% pass rate on page 5.
Typically what we will do in that situation is we will get information from other states that have a higher cut score to see how their candidates do. But obviously until people actually take the test, we won't have a guarantee number, but we could definitely come up with a target number for you if we were to raise those numbers.
That would be great. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, Madam.
We have three more questions, then we're going to have to move on. Representative Briner, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine should be pretty straightforward. Assistant Commissioner, I'm just wondering, I know we'll hear from Mackey when you're done, but I'm wondering the extent to which the colleges and universities in our state have been involved in the preparation of this proposal.
Commissioner Clendig.
This is the governor's proposal, so it doesn't necessarily come from MACD, and you will hear their response. Right now, we're a standards-based state, which is different from many states in the nation. So that we set standards at the Board of Teaching level that don't come with recommendations on credits or courses that need to be taken. unlike some other states. So as a result of that, you may have seen a number of studies, not just one, but about three or four different studies that have come out recently that have kind of ranked our teacher quality programs, the quality of our teacher prep programs, anywhere between a C and a D. I think that some of that has to do with our lack of consistency in defining what those are, and I'm hoping that we can work with the teacher colleges across the state to define that so that they can show to the world, you know, really how they really measure up with these other programs.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, you mentioned there are 22 states that are already doing this. How are their education results compared to ours?
Ms. Clemson or Mr. Miller?
Well, I can give you one. I mean, there's a number of states on here, but one example is Massachusetts, which just beat us on the TIMSS test. So there are in Oregon, which we look to for their use of the growth in tests and exam. We like their growth model. I know a number of legislators in here have looked at Oregon's growth model and said they like that. Wisconsin, our neighbor. So we can copy the test and give it to you, but certainly there are a number of states on here that do as well, if not better than us. With student performance.
Thank you. Could you get that information to all the committee members? Thank you. The last question will be Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I have known some teachers who have completed this program and not passed the PPSP, and that is unfortunate because they often get a long way, and they get actually think they're ready to teach, and then they can't pass the PPSP. It seems to me that we ought to be looking at the basic skills test in the beginning of when they enter the college, because and whether they have to pass it before they enter is one issue, but they certainly know, they ought to know in the beginning of their education training that this is something that a basic skills test is something they will have to pass. And they may decide if they can't pass it that maybe this isn't a career for them. But we want to have high standards for teachers entering the field, and we want to assure that our teachers going into the profession are also meeting high standards. So I certainly would look at this. The Board of Teaching, I assume, is involved, because and that is composed of teachers as well as others who I know have concerns about assuring that Minnesota has qualified people going into the field. But then in addition to people perhaps not having passed the PPSP, we still allow teachers with waivers and all kinds of other ways of teaching to be in the field because we don't have enough teachers. So we need to also address that issue.
Ms. Clinton, do you want to respond?
Well, again, I think that we want all of our teachers to make the passing their basic skills and have those basic skills. And we also know that they, we don't want them in the classroom necessarily with as many waivers. And we need to make sure we focus on the supply. So let's make sure that we get the basic skills test out of the way as soon as possible, focus on getting those teachers over that teacher prep, potential teacher prep candidates over that hump in the first couple of years, so that that's out of the way so that they can focus on that content mastery and pedagogy mastery that they're going to need. They don't need to be distracted with being able to do basic reading, writing, and math.
Thank you. We'll need to move on, but we really appreciate your testimony today. Thank you. Next, we have reactions from the Minnesota Association of College of Teacher Education, Dr. Michael Miller. I'll let her.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're ready now. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Miller. I'm Dean of the College of Education at Minnesota State University, Mankato.
And I'm Maureen Fred, and I'm currently president of MACSE, and I'm also with, I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State University, Mankato.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. We are here to speak on behalf of MACSE in response to some of these proposals, and we'll do so. I want to accomplish three things. I want to go through a handout that we've provided that portrays what exists. We have specific comments in response to the proposals, and then would like to engage in a little bit broader conversation, so would like just a few moments to raise some of those questions and issues about how we move forward. You will find the handout is the one with Minnesota licensure system at the top. Just very briefly, all candidates are required to take the practice one, the PPSP. We cannot require it at the beginning at this time because of legislation. It's been that way for the last 20, 30 years that we've had a conversation about this particular piece of it for a number of years. Institutions are required to provide support to candidates who are not passing the PPSP, so you will find at each of our institutions a formal process for intervening with those learners in an attempt to get them to pass. The grade point averages, we do a variety of measures to take a look at teacher quality and certainly teacher candidate quality. You can see some data there about the grade point averages that we have as we take a look at across our institutions. It is the case that GPA, in the first 2 years, that's when teacher ed candidates are taking gen ed courses along with majors in other areas. The GPAs are equivalent, and as candidates continue to move through their college education, the grade point averages of teacher education graduates are indeed equivalent to those who are not majoring in teacher preparation types of fields. The AACP or the ACT scores, the entrance exams in college, we have data that takes a look at state universities and some of our other institutions. There too, largely our candidates are equivalent. There are a couple fields in science, engineering, and technology and health-related fields where candidates don't have the ACT scores. They're not as strong, but in the main, they are as strong across most of the other majors, and GPA and student performance in school for our candidates tends to be quite strong. The program, we go through a rigorous set of approval processes. Our teaching majors need to have a great deal of content. Elementary majors have a broad-based kind of major, and so for that particular field, there's not a content major, an academic discipline beyond teacher preparation that's the major, but they do have a very broad and rigorous set of content courses because they're responsible for teaching a variety of those areas. The coursework is reviewed and specified by the standards that we have. For each of the teacher majors, there's a content set of standards and the standards of effective practice. Those are expansive lists of standards, and so what we do with our teacher candidates is highly prescribed and largely similar across our institutions. We do monitor progress of candidates. There are a number of gates, is what we call them, as they pass through the teacher preparation program. They need to keep their GPA up. They need to continue to perform in certain kinds of ways to make progress in order to continue. And the student teaching requirements at this point are 10 weeks, though what's typical across most of our institutions is at least 15 weeks in student teaching. Candidates are to pass Practice 1 and Practice 2 in order to be recommended for licensure. And so that's what we have there. The program approval process, and some of you I've had conversations about what PEPR means, but our program review process is highly prescribed again. For each of the courses that we have, we specify which standards in the expansive list are covered in that particular course, and we need to provide then materials about what happens on a day-to-day basis with those standards, how they're taught, how they're measured, and so on. Again, heavily prescribed. So we've built a system that is, requires a lot of accountability, and it's highly specified. It's fairly lockstep, and we do our best to make sure that everyone passing through is able to do what they need to do in order to teach kids well. Point number two is the response to the proposal. As I mentioned before, the PPSD is required for licensure. We have not been able to require for admission to the program. At multiple points through our history, we've advocated that. We've asked that question. We've wondered about it. And have been told that it's in legislation. We can't require it. Proceed. Do the best you can. You are required as teacher preparation institutions to work with all of those candidates in order to get them prepared. And so what you have at the end is 31 out of about 3,000 candidates who have not been able to pass that. In many cases, those are candidates from groups that experience language difficulties, ELL students for sure, and we've done our good things. I won't say our best, I won't say enough, because if someone isn't passing the test, that continues to be a concern for us. This particular item is one then that we would entertain a conversation. And there's two cautions that I would have. And that would be, what are the unintended consequences that would come as a result of this? Colleagues in Georgia, that is a state that does require PPSD at the beginning, experienced a large drop in the number of candidates of color, particularly African American teacher aid candidates. The numbers in the teacher preparation programs decreased rapidly. Now, I'm not here to try to explain that or why it happened. It was a consequence they felt, and so I would exercise caution. We're certainly not in a position to say this is an unreasonable or problematic kind of proposal. But it is more complex than it looks on the face of it. Strengthening the teacher certification process by raising the cut scores on teacher exams. That again is a proposal that looks on the face of it to be logical and appropriate. There were questions about how many graduates wouldn't pass those particular tests. What are the concerns? Again, looking at unintended consequences is a part of the process I'm sure that you'll attend to and others if we move forward with this. I think the teacher preparation has been moving in a little different direction to improve the certification process, and that would be the conversation I would hope that you would have. Looking at a standardized performance assessment of teaching. And New York and others California has a week-long assessment, performance assessment of teaching. And so instead of taking a look at changing a test score, let's take a look at a standardized measurement of the skills of teaching. Let's look at a common survey of preparation, a common survey of graduates across our programs, and a common survey of employers to take a look in a very high-quality way. We have a project going on with three of our institutions that's developed a very high-quality, perhaps some say the best survey instrument in the country in order to take a look at this. And so that would be something that might inform our programs even more than taking a look at a change of cut scores. And the third, I was just in a conversation with a school district employee, an assessment employee at Denver, and his comment was, if it's not about kid learning, it really doesn't matter. And so value-added assessment and evaluation of our programs and evaluation of our candidates and ongoing evaluation of teachers based upon student learning is absolutely necessary, and little else really matters in this conversation besides that. We're not geared to do that well yet, but we're all trying to move along that line, so until we get there, we're all just pretending that we're measuring things directly. The third item is revising the standards of effective practice to include more of an emphasis on technology content and teaching skills. Two responses on that. The Board of Teaching is currently in rulemaking in terms of adding more advanced technology skills. So a proposal to change legislation and rulemaking at the same time is a little confusing how that would play out. But certainly, we certainly need our graduates over the next forever to be always informed and using technology for learning as well as for teaching. So that is certainly a case. My other response in terms of revising SEPs, as I mentioned before, the lists of standards are staggeringly long. They're minute, and our response, our approval process requires us to go through and specify on what day, in what manner are they taught, and are they assessed. And so, I'm wondering if we shouldn't take a look at having fewer rather than more. It seems when everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. And so we have these lists, we have prescriptions. I'd love to be in a conversation about, again, what are the positive, well-intentioned pieces of this, and what's an unintended consequence in terms of the experience of teacher-ed candidates and their real ability to learn what they need to do with kids. It's a different conversation. And that gets me to the third point, and I will be as quick as I can on this. I'd like to try to characterize where we're at in the state and where we're at in the country in terms of our profession. I think there's an acknowledgement that we've done pretty well. We've done reasonably well across our schools and across our colleges of education for kids. In most contexts, with most students, most of the time, our people do well, and we've done well. But times have changed. Obviously, children aren't learning. Not all of our students are learning. We're not doing well enough, and we need to own that together. And so that's where we're at this point. I think as it's become clear that we're not doing well, there's been external pressure. So we see a variety of attempts at interventions on our schools, on our colleges of education, and those external pressures have led to these attempts for intervention that have caused our schools and certainly the colleges to feel fragmented and feel distracted by a variety of proposals that are logical from people's perspectives and certainly well-intentioned, but have not necessarily led to deep implementation of programs for a period of time that has allowed us really to figure out what we should be doing and how we should be succeeding. Also, inside teacher preparation, we've responded to this pressure as well. And there have been times when that's led to us taking a defensive stance and covering for ourselves. We do very well. We work very hard. Are we doing what we think we should be doing? Are we using the data? Are we engaged in conversations? Not always. We've led to tougher accreditation standards, longer lists of standards, and these defensive stances. And so while well-intentioned, we've created debilitating bureaucracies for ourselves and for students and our programs. And that's the push and pull that we have going on today in this conversation. Everyone's well-intentioned. Everyone wants to do better for kids. It's time that we focus there. And so the conflict needs to decrease, and we need to engage in a process of our conversation about what it is. The conversation has changed. We need to accept responsibility for student success. Our higher ed institutions and our teacher education programs need to be about kids, and we need to embrace that. We need to work with schools to improve learning now. We need to work with philanthropic organizations such as Mr. Hutchinson and the Bush Foundation to take a look at what can we do to change the process substantially so that we can do that work. In this committee meeting on your first day, many of you talked about removing some of the constraints, having great data, providing flexibility to work over time on that. And so the answer lies in implementing what we know much more intensely. Removing barriers within our institutions and for our institutions, increasing our partnerships, and being professional about all of that. The answer lies in fewer distractions, not, and more focus on data and instruction. We need to take a look at teacher residencies and school-based teacher preparation, such as the programs in Denver and Chicago. There are some great results there with tough populations similar to some of our places here. And so what I'd like to do is say that we're interested. Matthew is interested in that conversation coming together, owning the fact that we haven't done enough and wanting to lead much quicker towards deep implementation in school. So I want you to imagine a school where master teachers and beginning teachers and teachers in preparation and underprepared teachers from Teacher America and college faculty and school leaders all come together to co-teach, to learn to teach in a context where everyone is learning to teach. That would be a different kind of a process, a different kind of an experience. The recruitment, I'd like you to imagine how it would be to have those kinds of people in the schools together. Teachers in preparation right there with the students. It seems to me that that's maybe the silver bullet to recruitment. Well, I can show you our 29-point plan for having a more diverse teacher workforce, and the results just don't reflect the kind of success we would hope for. But in that kind of a school-based model, where higher ed and P-12 are working together in the school with learners at that particular time, we can probably recruit much better. So that would be my hope. The retention courses, our teachers go into classrooms, go into schools by themselves, struggle, and they leave the profession when it's too much, when the systems of support are not there. And so in that kind of a school where everyone's wrapped around, where the teacher education curriculum is wrapped around the students, not the other way around, my guess is it's a much more professional atmosphere, and there's much higher likelihood to be able to retain the teachers that we need. And then I'd want you to imagine the student learning based in that kind of a program. That's the conversation we're hoping to have.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. We really appreciate your insight. We have time for one question. Representative Swales, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank both of you from coming from Mankato. I have had the opportunity to be a supervising teacher for several student teachers now. My very first one came from Mankato, and she was just an outstanding young woman and was able to be hired within my school district and continue teaching there, and it's so wonderful to call her a colleague now, and thank you for the excellent programs that you provide there. My comment is that it was a little bit difficult for me to discern, Dr. Miller, if you are supportive of what the governor's proposals are. It seems to me, as you were speaking, that you had specific reservations, and the one thing that you mentioned that I heard, and please help me understand if this is correct or not, but I thought I understood you to say that you felt a more effective tool for determining a teacher if a teacher is prepared to be in the classroom or not is a survey that you provide. And if I was correct in understanding that, could you please describe the survey that you use within your teacher preparation system? Dr. Miller.
Okay. You are correct that for each of these proposals, each of them makes sense. There are unintended consequences that may come about, and so my comments are in that general support as to say, and what's going to happen if we do this, and can we figure out something to go along with it. The teacher tests, practice 1 and 2, tell part of the story. They don't tell the whole story. And so my addition is to say we would have more information if we would have a very intensive performance assessment process at the end. The system in California is a week long. Teacher candidates prepare a week of instruction. They teach it. They reflect every night and revise their plans. They videotape themselves. They take a look at student learning data at the end of that. They reflect about that. And master teachers look at all of it and decide if they've done a good job or not. That's a fairly intensive process, but it tells you more than the exams at the end. Surveys. There are good surveys and there are bad surveys. And the University of Minnesota and Mankato and the College of St. Kate have, on behalf of MACSE, developed a modified survey, taking a look at all the surveys across the country, and develop a survey that does get into a lot of detail about what people feel prepared to do and what they feel like they've been able to do with students at the end of the first year. And so that tells another part of the story, their own sense of confidence about their ability to modify based upon who's in front of them in the classroom. That's a different kind of information than the exam from the beginning. The value-added assessment is all about student data at the end, and that's the infrastructure that we need. We don't have. We cannot understand what's happening with our students necessarily based upon their own test scores. There are limitations with that, but that was all part of the story.
Thank you. I apologize that we have to move on, but I really appreciate your coming today and sharing, and thank you, Dr. Preen, for also coming. Next, we have Dr. Misty Sato from the College of Education Human Development at the University of Minnesota with her reactions. Welcome to the committee. Could you please identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent?
Thank you. My name is Misty Sato. I am an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota in the College of Education and Human Development with a focus on teacher development and teacher education. I'd like to talk a little bit about teacher development from a broader context and put some research-based perspective around some of the proposals that are here today. I want to begin by agreeing with the premise of the governor's proposal that we are in a situation of having 21st century learning goals to be more strongly attended to in teaching and teacher preparation, and also agree from a research perspective that teacher effectiveness is the most highly correlated factor for student achievement when you look at a compilation of studies that look at how student achievement can be supported. But I want to imagine what it means for us to think about teacher effectiveness along a whole continuum of professional learning for teachers, and I'll focus on the teacher preparation dimension of it, but from a research perspective, looking at just that one piece of it without attending to those early career induction times for the teacher and on into the professional learning dimensions of professional teaching, you just can't have that one piece without considering it within the whole. So if we start with, you know, how do we get teachers into teacher preparation programs, it starts in their K-12 experience. That people experience a period of education where they see what teaching looks like, and that greatly influences the kind of teacher that they become. So that's another dimension of this work that goes on in teacher preparation, is tapping into that what has been called the apprenticeship of observation from living in K-12 classrooms for 12 years as a student, and how that influences the way that you become a teacher. That has some influence on also how we recruit teachers into the profession and tap into the kinds of enthusiasm that people have for wanting to become a teacher. Setting minimum entrance requirements prior to entering teacher preparation is one of the proposals on the table today. And within the realm of looking at how this could affect the screening process, as someone called, you know, the winnowing effect of having an entrance exam, I want to just speak a little bit to some of the research that has been done around these kinds of entrance exams for teachers. We do know that almost 40 states use Practice 1 for teacher prep admissions or for granting licensure. Research does show that teacher performance on tests that measure quality, such as verbal ability, are related to gains in student achievement. So from that perspective, some basic skills are shown to be supportive of later student achievement gains, but they tend to be primarily housed in the verbal ability of the teacher. There have been no studies specifically related to the Practice 1 exam that support the claim that leads to heightened scores on the Practice 1 lead to student achievement. The studies that were done that supports this notion that basic skills have an impact on student achievement were done with other kinds of measures, much more limited than the Practice 1 exam were done. And they were done in 20, 30, 40 years ago. I also point out here that the characteristics of teaching that we would identify as good teaching, what one representative pointed out is like the art of teaching, don't have systematic measures at the entrance requirements. So we don't have research data that would point to some of the dispositions that teachers might have and the impact that that would have on later student achievement. If we could measure things like how much do you care about kids, what is your, you know, what's your stance on relationships with children, we don't have systematic measures to say that. So most of the research literature that talks about quality of teacher effectiveness tend to be on these measurable dimensions of test scores and verbal ability. I just want to point out the absence of that data, because lots of times in the conversations about what makes a good teacher, that art of teaching and the relational dimension is very important from a personal perspective once you interview people about it, but we don't have those measures in the research literature. We also have in the research literature, a myth that floats around quite a bit about how candidates in teacher preparation programs are less academically capable than other college graduates. And I want to break that myth apart a little bit today. Sometimes when people point to teachers who are not academically capable or candidates in teacher preparation programs as being less capable than their other college peers, often rely on studies that were done prior to the 1980s, and they use students' high school career intentions as the measure of looking at the ACT scores of students who in high school said, yes, I plan to become a teacher. But it turns out that that population is not the population that actually becomes teachers. There's a great drop-off from the time that you say that in high school to the time that you actually make it through the teacher preparation programs and graduate. We also saw a period of sweeping reforms in teacher education in the 1980s, increased standards, rise in GPA scores, requirements for entrance into teacher preparation, increased accreditation standards for teacher education. So when we look at the data today, studies from the 90s and early 2000s, the differences among the college students that are reported, prospective teachers tend to have lower college entry test scores, but higher academic achievement as measured by high school GPA and rank and college GPA. There also tends to be a gender imbalance in this data because the teaching profession is predominantly women. Women tend to have higher GPAs and tend to score lower on standardized tests. So that sort of speaks to the population that's being tested here. We also have that more low ability students exit the teacher pipeline at each successive stage. So as you move from high school graduation, college entry into teacher prep, graduation from college, the dropout from that population tends to be the lower performing or lower academically capable students within that population. So those who are prepared to teach, by the end you get to the graduation from teacher preparation program and entering into teaching, they have higher than average SAT and ACT scores compared to students entering college. And although their average SAT and ACT scores are slightly lower than that of other college graduates, those preparing for secondary teaching in the core content areas have comparable scores to other college graduates. So I think this mirrors the data that Dean Miller shared with us today about Minnesota's graduates. We have reasonably high GPA and ACT scores within our teacher population. So if we look at those measures of academic capability, in comparison to the Praxis 1 test capability, we have a population of teachers who are academically capable. One other point here is that the top students with top SAT scores and ACTs in the top quartile, they're less likely to take jobs in teaching, even though they've been through a teacher preparation program. And once they enter the classroom, they're the population that are less likely to stay in the classroom. So even if we attend to this recruitment issue of getting the best and brightest into the classroom with our children in Minnesota, we would have to counter that with attention to keeping them in the classroom. And that would speak to some of the induction issues that I'll talk about later, that if that's the group we want in classrooms, then we need to support them after we get them into the classroom. So it makes good sense to recruit candidates who have strong academic capability into teaching when they already have a pool that's strong, but there's a significant trade-off here. That screening out teacher candidates who we need to to get into teaching on the principle of diversifying the teaching population. There's a disparity in test scores along race and class categories. We know that teachers are predominantly white middle-class women, while our student populations are increasingly from diverse ethnic, cultural, and socioeconomic backgrounds. So from a teacher preparation perspective, we stand on principle that we need to diversify our teaching population. But we know that setting tougher testing standards and higher testing standards might hold promise for ensuring teachers are academically able. But if we don't consider this judiciously, such testing can exacerbate the already daunting problems with the supply and diversity of potential teachers. An ETS study showed that raising the Practice 1 score to the highest cutoff that's currently used would increase the racial and ethnic gap within the teaching population. And as Dean Miller pointed out too, history has shown that in states that have instituted an entry requirement with the Praxis 1, have seen declined populations of teachers of color within the teacher population. So it's a serious trade-off that we would have in standing on principle of diversifying the teaching population versus trying to increase the academic capability numbers around who is in the classroom. We get to the within this professional continuum of preparing teachers for the within teacher preparation programs, and the proposal on the table today is about not requiring equivalence of an academic major in core content areas where teacher candidates are preparing to teach. So we know from the research literature that subject matter preparation has been shown to be related to student achievement gains. Those findings are the strongest in the subject area of mathematics. The research isn't there for English and language arts and social studies education. It's there for science, and it shows the correlation of subject matter preparation in science as well, but it's strongest in the field of mathematics. The question I want to raise today is whether increasing the cut score on the licensing exam is the way for a teacher to demonstrate subject matter understanding. Critics of using subject matter tests point out that the content exams often are test a very narrow domain of content knowledge understanding. There are other measures that could be used for demonstrating that you have your content area understanding. One of those would be course taking in the subject area, and that's been found more frequently to be related to teacher performance than have scores on tests of subject matter knowledge. That's not showing performance on our students' academic achievement, but scores on measures of teacher performance within the teacher preparation programs. The question then would be how much course taking would we need to represent content knowledge understanding. Content preparation is measured by coursework in the subject field. It's positively related to student achievement in mathematics and science, but the relationship is curvilinear. So there's a ceiling effect on how much coursework do you need to actually be able to enter teaching and have an effect on your students. You need a full major. Some studies suggest that there's a cap of maybe 5 courses in mathematics that would give you enough content knowledge to be effective with students. So it could be that requiring a minor in the content field would suffice to have enough content knowledge. There's also a lot of research about what the content courses that are done specifically in subject matter teaching. So it may not be only the content courses in the major fields, but how do you learn your content for the purposes of teaching? There have been correlational regression analysis studies that show that the time that teachers spend in pedagogical content knowledge courses, the methods of teaching, have greater impact on student achievement than the relationship of courses in the academic major have on student achievement. So when we're talking about content knowledge preparation, we have to consider in the content major courses in conjunction with the teaching of the content courses, the education side of the equation. Research has also shown that teachers' coursework in content areas specific methods are significantly related to student achievement. that are related to tasks requiring problem solving and application. And this is primarily in the field of science. And this speaks to those 21st century learning goals that are the overarching premise of what we're trying to improve here. So, again, the methods are you teaching science in an inquiry-based way? Are you helping children understand the principles and nature of science? Is more related to the methods of teaching science than it is to the academic major of science. Just a couple more points on this dimension, that some people would look at the degree type to as a measure of whether or not you have your content knowledge. Does it matter if you're a major in education versus does it matter if you're a major in your content area field with education as your minor, or you're in a post-baccalaureate situation of having a degree and then you move into education. And there's been very little relationship that you can identify based on the kind of degree that a teacher has and the kind of influence that they have on student achievement. Some people think that this, that being part of an education program has a standardizing influence across the degree. So you can have, you don't necessarily have to have a degree in your field to be an effective teacher. When we talk about entering teaching then on our professional continuum, now we have standards that the teachers are working, are held accountable for effective practice. There's a proposal that we have increased the rigor of the standards and increased the number of standards to really emphasize the technology skills and critical thinking skills. I want to point out that from a peer perspective, Minnesota is viewed as a rigorous state by our peers with regard to its standards of effective practice. It was an early adopter of standards of effective practice, and as Dean Miller pointed out, there is a very specified process for demonstrating that the preparation programs in Minnesota are meeting those standards. I would encourage you to look at the Minnesota Administrative Rules for the Standards of Effective Practice to see the list that already exists. I'll read to you a couple that I think already speak to the proposal that's on the table.
Dr. Sadel,
yeah.
We have just a few minutes, if you could wrap it up.
All right. Then I'll just move on to just mentioning this point about transitioning from teacher preparation into the early career dimension of teaching, what we call the induction phase of teaching, the first 1 to 3 years that a teacher is in the classroom. And the importance from a preparation perspective to provide a seamless transition from the College of Education, from the preparation into that early career, and the research that supports that teachers who have access to an induction are retained in the profession for longer periods of time, are that there's a financial payoff for school districts to invest in induction work with teachers so that you're not always in a hiring and recruiting phase of getting teachers into the classroom, and that the professional growth of teachers in induction can continue from preparation into that early career, that you're continuing to be in a learning phase in those first few years of teaching. We have been working on this with an organization that we call the Teacher Support Partnership, and I mention it because it's one of the handouts that we provided today to show that a number of institutions, including Education Minnesota, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, and the Department of Education, have been working together to develop a set of guidelines that would support high-quality induction for teachers, so that as we're looking not only at the graduation from teacher preparation programs and demonstration of that content area mastery and pedagogical mastery, that we're continuing to support teachers into their early career so that all that preparation time gets payoff in retention of teachers once they enter the profession. And that would include those best and brightest that we've recruited into the teaching to keep them in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I apologize. We don't have time for questions, but I would assume that you would be available to answer questions afterwards.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Peter Hutchinson from the Bush Foundation. Welcome to the committee.
And good morning. I'm glad to be here. My name is Peter Hutchinson. I have the honor of being the president of the Bush Foundation. Just a quick reminder of what the Bush Foundation is. Archibald Bush was a farmer from Granite Falls who had asthma. decided he needed a better life, so he moved to Two Harbors, went to work for a little company that tried to turn Corundum into something useful. As the assistant accountant to a guy named McKnight, the two of them became 3M. There's a McKnight Foundation, that was McKnight Foundation, Bush is the Bush Foundation. And we in Minnesota are lucky, and I'm among the luckiest. The Bush Foundation about 7 or 8 months ago decided to focus all of its work for the next 10 years on three things. Building and sustaining leaders in this state and the communities that need them, serving the sovereign needs of the tribal nations in the three states in which we operate, which are Minnesota, North, and South Dakota, and educational achievement. This morning I just want to focus on, obviously, on educational achievement. And in particular, we've decided to focus virtually all of our efforts with respect to education on teacher preparation for the simple reason that it makes the most difference. We're desperately concerned about educational outcomes in this state and the other two and in the achievement gap. And the data that's available nationwide makes it crystal clear. Students that have effective teachers learn. And effective teachers are the single most powerful strategy we have to eliminate the educational gap that we see in our schools today. And it just feels like that's what we ought to work on. In the next 10 years or so in these three states, we will replace actually 25,000 teachers. That's going to happen. The question is, are they going to be the most effective teachers available to our kids or not? So we're focusing all of our energies on where those next 25,000 teachers are going to come from. If we are going to replace them, natural retirement and so on is going to make that necessary. We are, as a consequence, looking very hard and working with Mike and his colleagues and the K-12 systems on the question of how should we design teacher preparation programs that recruit the most academically capable, train them successfully, place them where they can make the most difference, and retain them for the longest time possible. That is the core of what we're working on. Now, just one important fact, I think, is that in Minnesota, at least, it's actually also true in North Dakota, we're preparing many, many, many more teachers than we hire. We're preparing roughly 5,000 teachers in Minnesota for 2,500 jobs every year. Yes, there are shortages in specific fields, but we are vastly over-preparing teachers. We think, therefore, that a strategy to get the 25,000 most effective teachers that we can would involve the following core elements. First, we do think admission requirements are essential. We need to raise the bar, but more importantly, we need to raise the expectation about who ought to be in teaching. Teaching is a wonderful career. It's a fabulous profession. We ought to make that clear to folks. So it's not just about raising the bar. It's actually aggressively and effectively recruiting the very best people to go into teaching. We're going to need recruitment tools to make that possible. A recruitment program for sure, but we've got to be looking at things like tax credits and debt forgiveness and so on so that young people that choose to go into teaching will really feel as though they're going to get rewarded. But perhaps most importantly, we have to rethink how we pay for teacher preparation. If you believe what I told you just a second ago, that we prepare twice as many teachers as we had to hire, we lose half the ones we hire within the next 4 or 5 years. From your point of view as public policymakers, you're paying for 4 teachers but only getting 1. That's a really bad investment. No one would do that on purpose. If you took the same amount of money, instead of paying for 5,000 teachers but only hiring 2,500, the same amount of money, prepare 2,500 teachers but support them all the way through their teacher preparation and induction, you'd have a much more successful system, much more successful. Higher quality, greater effectiveness, lower turnover. That's the kind of system that we think we in Minnesota could create. And we're putting a tremendous amount of energy into this. This requires us literally to rethink how we do things. And it's going to require the legislature to rethink a little bit how you do things. And one of the curious questions is this: if effective teaching is really the most powerful strategy to our K-12 objectives, why is the funding for effective teaching run through the higher ed committee and not through K-12? Shouldn't you all be the people purchasing effective teachers instead of somebody else paying for enrollment? This strikes me as an obvious change that you ought to think about making as part of a commitment to getting the kind of outcome that we're looking for.
It's also going to require us to have the down and dirty debate about what makes for effective teaching. How do we know it? How do we know it's out there? And we got plenty of bright people in this state and in the country that are willing to sit down and help us do it. All of them will tell you it has to include value-added assessment, but that's not enough. But it has to be there. Well, right now in our state, we don't have either. So let's get going on that question as well. How will we know effective teaching? How can we assess it? But more importantly, how will a teacher personally know whether they're being effective and have the data they need to improve that? We're going to have to look at pay and ways to take the commitment to effective outcomes and effective teaching and put it into the pay system. And we're going to have to demand that our school districts think differently about who they hire. You just simply can't allow school districts to reward them in any way for hiring ineffective teachers. And we've got to make sure that the very best teachers go into the profession, that they're given every opportunity to succeed, and when they demonstrate that success, they have an opportunity to actually teach. We're working with the higher ed systems to design, we hope, a system in which teachers would come into the preparation program knowing where their job was going to be, knowing who they were going to be teaching, and preparing specifically for that job. That the teacher preparation system would look more like the way we prepare doctors and less like the way we prepare almost everybody else. So that graduation is not the end of your relationship with your higher ed institution, it's only the midpoint. And that for those first 4 years after you graduate, you're actually still enrolled in the college that prepared you, and they accept responsibility for supporting you with coaching and mentoring and summer programs, whatever you need, because they're going to guarantee the effectiveness of the teaching. The higher ed systems would guarantee the effectiveness of the teaching, while the K-12 systems would guarantee to hire those effective teachers. It's a unique opportunity, we think, to make a pretty sweet deal that would really benefit our kids. These dual guarantees, on the one hand, we'll guarantee that we'll produce people who can actually teach. On the other hand, we'll guarantee we'll put them in classrooms where they're really needed. The thing that ties those two things together, then, is having the data system so that our teachers are surrounded with the information they need to become not just effective, but unbelievably great. And we know that's possible. That's what we're up to. We're working hard with everybody who's willing to work on this, and frankly, it's not everybody, and that's okay. But my board, anyway, is pretty clear with me that 10 years hence, and I expect to be here 10 years hence, they're going to ask me, how many effective teachers do we have in Minnesota? And I want to be able to say we got at least 25,000. Because the difference it'll make for our kids will be, unbelievable. Just one little addition. It is so incredibly important that we have a diverse workforce in our classroom. And I get asked all the time, how is that going to happen if you're raising standards? And to me, it's really straightforward. If our schools were succeeding with all our kids, we would have plenty of diversity in our colleges. And the best of the brightest of that diversity would go into teaching. Well, if the place to start is making sure that we're graduating all kids successfully. And we know the best strategy to do that is effective teaching today. So absolutely, we must get there. But we have to get there by building a system that can sustain itself over time. Those kids that are going to teach our kids 4 years from now are sitting in our high schools today. The question is, are they getting the effective instruction they need today that's going to turn them on to teaching and put them in a college setting where they can succeed? I used to kid Louise Sundin all the time. I don't understand how we can have these kids in our classrooms for 13 years and not get more of them to go into teaching. We've got a captive audience in our schools for 13 years and we can't get more of them turned on to teaching. That's our fault. We adults have to do something about that. You can tell I'm a wild-eyed optimist. I think you could do this, though. Done.
Thank you. I know you've inspired me to think outside the box. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Beatrice.
Yes, thank you. I think that kids, you talk about the high schools today are going to be the future teachers very soon, and I think they are inspired until reality hits. I'm going to go to college for 4 years, in debt, and I'm going to make $30,000 a year.
Right, we have to show them the way out of it.
Move back with mom and dad. They'll work out fine.
They've already moved home with me.
Right. That is just a recipe for disaster.
So excuse me.
Mr. Hutchins.
Absolutely. And so part of the recruitment process has got to address this question, because we've got to change our conception and their conception of what it means to be a teacher. So on the one hand, we have to show them how the pay system could be changed so that they actually get rewarded for being a professional. And we can also show them, through credits and debt forgiveness, ways in which we can make the college experience more affordable for them. That's a package of things that we're going to need to put in place, and we will not succeed.
Right, and you know, so much of what we talk about in this room, you know, sounds so great, you know, tax credits and all that type of stuff. Well, I just actually had this short little conversation with my son last night, where he was we don't encourage the profession in our family, but you know, he was inkling, you know, I wouldn't mind being a teacher. Well, I'm not going to say, well, honey, you really should, because you'll get tax credits, you know, until the legislature takes them away. You know, I mean, is this, you know, that sounds so lucrative to us, and you know, that's the carrot, but it's in today's world, it's really nothing to change your profession on and how you're going to spend the next 4 years at college. I just want to have one last question for you. Did you happen to see I'm kind of excited about this because I just read it and I think it's old news, but the superintendent from Washington, D.C., the new superintendent there, and the different pay proposals that she has thrown out there. Have you read that? Have you read anything of that? Any comments?
Well, Michelle Rhee is an unusual person. She's a product of Teach for America. And Teach for America, by the way, is the poster child for whether or not you can get really fabulous people to go into teaching. They're doing it. They're getting 10% of Harvard's graduating class to go into teaching. We obviously are not doing what we could do to make that happen here. On pay, Michelle Rhee's proposals are very controversial, and in fact, they're not going anywhere.
Right.
They've been rejected. We don't have to go that far to make our pay system work for really highly effective new teachers coming out of our teacher preparation program. We already have, in most of our contracts, maybe every contract in Minnesota, the ability to pay teachers more if they're nationally board certified. National board certification is presumptive evidence of effectiveness. Why can't we use other effective measures, like having been incredibly well prepared and demonstrating that effectiveness in the classroom, and moving people up on the salary schedule? Secondly, we thought through this question of whether or not if a student is still enrolled for 4 years after they graduate, so they're still a customer, if you will, of the higher ed system, if the induction process itself deepens their effectiveness, depending on how that's organized, that could lead them to a master's degree or some other higher level, which also moves them up just on the salary schedules we have today. So I believe there actually is a way to, working within the constructs as they exist today, to create a much more attractive professional direction for folks. But I also think we should never forget, and I actually think TFA really illustrates this, people go into teaching not to make money. It's a passion. Now, they shouldn't become poor as a consequence, so we do have to fix this, but we should not ever pretend that it isn't also passion that pulls people into this profession. What they want to know, in addition to whether or not they're going to survive, is will that passion be energized over time? Will they actually get the chance to change kids' lives? And if they're really well prepared to be effective in classrooms, I think they will. And my little survey on this is every Thanksgiving, a whole bunch of Teach for America kids come to our house for Thanksgiving because they have nowhere else to go. They're out in South Dakota and they can't get all the way back home, and so we're the midpoint. So I do this little analysis every Thanksgiving. We're in year three right now, and you can just see it in these kids. The first year, they're out there, they're floundering, they're alone, they're scared, they don't know what they're doing. They sit around our living room doing lesson plans through the entire Thanksgiving holiday. Second year, they come back, and I ask them, how are you doing? Well, it's just so much better. Are you going to sign up for a third year? Because it's not required. They're all signing up for a third year. Why is that? Because I'm just figuring out how to make this work successfully. People want to succeed. They want to have the tools for success. We just have to make sure we organize the system to give them those tools. And if we do, my own view is without spending a hell of a lot more money, we could just get a fantastic K-12 system here. And we can do something that hasn't been done in any other place in the country. We put all these pieces together, all the ones you've heard about today. We're going to have something really special.
Thank you. I've got four people that want to ask questions, and we have about 3 or 4 minutes. And also, Dan Osslager wants to have a minute. So if we could keep our questions brief. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going back to the PPSG, and you touched on it, and the unintended consequences, particularly for the issues of diversity and the achievement gap, which causes that problem of many of our students who aren't successful in high school and then not being able to pass a PPSG, quite frankly. And eventually, as we become more effective in narrowing the achievement gap, that should disappear. But do you have any ideas for a transition, or have you talked about that, a transition time before we graduate all of our, before we narrow the achievement gap? How do we deal with PTSD and that issue of diversity?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My own view is you're not going to find a transition strategy. I think the best way to get after this is to get effective teachers in front of our kids now or as soon as we possibly can. And that'll mean recruiting differently, recruiting from different age groups even, alternative licensing that allow people who are committed to teaching and are very well prepared otherwise to learn the pedagogy, get them in classrooms where they can make a difference as soon as humanly possible. Because I think when I was superintendent, we tried 72 different programs to get different outcomes. And fundamentally, it's the teacher in the classroom that we need to rely on. And so let's get the very best teachers we can in our classroom.
Yes, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you were saying then that we would maintain the PTSD, or you would support the PTSD, but maybe with with some kind of support system. And I know there have been support systems to help people pass that particular test in the beginning, and it might be wise to continue it and help have support systems. I love your ideas of the induction. I think those are really important.
A little bit controversial, I'd like our teachers to be so great that the PPSD is irrelevant. It should be irrelevant. Our teachers should be so capable and confident that passing this test should not be anything that anyone even thinks about. The fact that we're even having to debate it is, to me, is prima facie evidence of the challenge we got.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. The other representatives have said that they would not ask their questions today, but I'm sure they'd like to talk with you later. Jan Oschlager would like to speak for just a moment.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Oschlager, Education Minnesota, and I originally asked to sign up because I wasn't hearing anything about the diversity issue and the need to have diverse teachers working in their schools. And so I think that has been hit. But I think I would also like to say the one word that I have not heard here today, and that's respect for our teachers. I think we could go a long way to have more respect and honoring of our teachers, higher pay, I've heard that. National Board Professional Teaching Standards, I was glad to hear that Peter Hutchinson mentioned that. That is a proposal that our locals propose at the bargaining table all the time. There are very few contracts that have it in their that language in the contract. I think mentoring, many of these ideas are great. Preparing in advance for the teachers, whether the cut score is to be raised or not, I think that that's debatable in terms of the preparation, the remediation that you give these individuals. But competition versus collaboration, putting all the resources in trying to get people to work together to improve the schools, mentoring for our new teachers, so that they can be successful. I think all of those are very important.
Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.